very much for coming in such large numbers this evening. We're delighted to welcome you to this debate this evening, entitled Darwin and Humanity, Should We Rid the Mind of God? We are especially pleased to welcome our two speakers this evening, Professor Alistair McGrath and Professor Peter Atkins. My name is Joshua Horden. I am representing the Christian Union, and I'm also a member of the Philosophy Society. In a moment, I'll be passing over to Yelena Alexic, the President of the Philosophy Society, who will be introducing Alistair McGrath. So we're now going to introduce the two speakers. We are really delighted to welcome them both. And I'll start with Professor Peter Atkins. Peter Atkins was educated at the University of Leicester, then went on to UCLA as a Harkins Fellow. He returned to Oxford in 1965 as Fellow of Lincoln College and is now Professor of Chemistry. Currently, he is acting rector of Lincoln College. His research interests were in theoretical chemistry, but he now spends most of his time writing. He's written about 60 books, most of them are textbooks, but a number of them books on science for the general public, including Creation Revisited and Galileo's Finger. When not writing, Professor Atkins tries to stamp out religion. I now invite Yelena Alexic.
Good evening, everyone. Lovely to see so many of you here tonight. It's amazing. I'm going to tell you a bit about Professor Alistair McGrath. Alistair McGrath studied chemistry at Oxford and went on to do his DPhil in molecular biophysics under Professor Sir George Rada, who went on to become chairman of the Medical Research Council. A former atheist, he converted to Christianity at Oxford and went on to study Christian theology, specialising in the relation between science and religion. He has been Professor of Historical Theology at Oxford University since 1999. And let us welcome Professor Alistair McGrath.
So may I now invite Professor Peter Atkins to begin our debate this evening.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It is a pleasure to be in Edinburgh, very much the home, in my view, of rational thought. But only minds free of delusions can be truly rational. That the concept of God is a delusion should be apparent to any right-thinking person. Therefore, if we seek rationality, and presumably we prefer to be rational rather than irrational, then surely we must rid the mind of God. Now the concept of God, in my view, is not wholly bad when viewed from an historical perspective, but it is now outworn. As our bewildered ancestors dropped from the trees, they sought solace and explanation. They formed the view, as they were tossed around by fate, that there were gods to be cajoled and appeased. That was the first glimmering of the view that the universe was open to explanation. And as time went on, those individual gods were incorporated into a globalized god. That global corporation continued to represent the search for explanation is good. However, that explanatory aspect of God, its crystalline core, accreted sort of sentimental consort for people confronted by the great questions of being, such as why we are here and the nature of good. Those who could not come to terms with the prospect of their own annihilation ascribed to God characteristics for which there was no justification except sentimental wishful thinking. The scientific method emerged from the crucible of religion, sentiment giving way to experiment. And experiments proved to be a far more powerful way to establish understanding than sentiment. First, scientists discovered the workings of the physical universe, the laws governing the inanimate. Here, Newton is the symbol of achievement. Then we overcame the mystery of the organic world, and here, Darwin is the symbol an achievement. The Derwin features in the title this evening is because although an understanding of the inorganic can be perceived as bearing little threat to the role of God in the workings of the world, the displacement of man's special place as God's creation in his own image by a view that man is just a serendipitous outcome of the horrid, bloody processes of natural selection treads squarely on religion's tender spot. I will not describe to any of you here belief in the ludicrous alternative to evolution, that of so-called intelligent design. I would presume that even those of you of a religious bent can accommodate natural selection as a mode by which a God might have permitted man to emerge, even though it must seem rather odd that he chose such a bloody way of letting it happen. Instead, I will use Darwin's presence in the topic this evening as a springboard to what must be achieved in this debate to rid ourselves of the concept of God entirely. As Newton and his successors, we comprehend the inorganic without the need to invoke a God. With Darwin and his successors, we comprehend the organic without the need to invoke a God. Is there nothing in the universe that needs the concept of a God? If there is not, then our minds should be rid of him. Some believe that a God is necessary for there to be a purpose in the universe. For to them it seems absurd that all there is should be here without a purpose. But why should there be a purpose in the universe? Why can't it be wholly without purpose? It's wholly inappropriate to assert that the universe must have a purpose, and then to infer that that assertion is evidence for there being a God. There's not the slightest evidence that there is any purpose in the universe, and a perfectly purposeless universe is perfectly conceivable. But in the evidence, evidence that is not merely wishful thinking, that the universe has a purpose, and only then will I begin to believe that there might be a God behind it. Some believe that a God is necessary for the creation of the universe, for how can so much come from absolutely nothing without intervention? Now, that is a much harder problem. For although cosmology has taken enormous strides in recent decades, cosmogenesis is a far, far harder problem. I must admit that we simply do not know how a universe can come into being without intervention. But science is moving cautiously towards a solution as it edges closer and closer to the moment of inception and discovers more and more about the fabric of reality. There is not the slightest hint that we shall have to invoke the finger of God in the coming into being of our world. Contrast the effort currently going into that understanding with the epitome of defeatist, lazy explanations represented by the phrase that God did it. Some believe that a God is necessary for the choice of a benign palette of fundamental constants, a palette that with an even slightly different hue could not have led to you and me. Who knows where the truth lies here? It may be that there is an infinite number of universes that have tumbled unceremoniously and haphazardly out of nothing, the whole galaxy of fundamental constants, and we are simply the inhabitants of one lucky example. Alternatively, it may be that the universe must have our palette of fundamental constants, and that conscious life is a happy but essentially inconsequential property. There is no reason to suppose, except longing, that there is a God behind the choice. Some believe that a God is necessary for the emergence of a spiritual dimension to man's personality, and cannot conceive of there being a solely physical basis of love, artistic creativity, worship of things unseen, and the profound sense of faith that some are said to possess. How can it possibly be that billions know in their hearts that there is a God, unless there is indeed a God? If, as I believe, we can extrapolate from Newton through Darwin, then just as science has elucidated the inorganic and the organic, I see absolutely no impediments to science being able to elucidate the workings of the human brain. We're already beginning to understand the physiological and neurological basis of life, and have inklings of the physiological basis of the nature of artistic creativity. We're beginning to understand the undisguised madness. It's not hard to understand the socially acceptable forms of madness that are captured by religion. That is especially the case when religious attitudes are pressed on individuals from cradle to grave. Psychological pressures and cultural conditioning that stem from religion's capture of the arts. The cross, the crescent, the sickle, and the swastika are the supreme icons of control. None of this understanding reveals a core of inner life and godness. Some believe that a God is necessary for the distinction between good and evil. The irony of this view seems to be lost on those of religious persuasion, for the God of the Old Testament is almost without exception a ranting old tyrant whose emulation by an individual would result in years of penal servitude. Here you have a choice. You may believe that our perception of what is good and what is evil can be traced to the authority of old tribal texts, or you can achieve deep understanding in terms of our evolutionary history and the bigness of our brains that allows us to reflect on the consequences of our actions for a cohesive society. Surely ethology is more revealing than mythology. Appealing to God as the source of good is wholly empty. Let us rid our minds of that deceit and try to understand our nature scientifically in the light of our evolution. I see no need to invoke a God as a component of the answer to any of the great questions of being. There is no evidence. The majority opinion is not evidence. But does it matter? Is there any harm in belief in these fairy stories? On the good side, these fantasies inspire great art, and the world would be poorer than without them. On the bad side, the concept of God has inspired terrible evil. As there is no experimental proof of the correctness of one view of God or another, the only recourse to settling the matter is the sword and its modern analogues. God, it cannot be denied, has inspired war after war, murder after murder. How can it be that some still worship him? God has also inspired belief in that most terrible fantasy of all, the afterlife. That belief is terrible because it thwarts aspirations in this life and inspires believers to dreadful deeds in the expectation in due course of sitting on God's right hand. Darwin's legacy is a wonderful legacy. It is essentially that we can know ourselves, that we can know ourselves, in fact, on this side of the grave. It is indeed time to celebrate the apotheosis of the Enlightenment by ridding our minds of God. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, rather fewer, but very welcome. It is a wonderful pleasure to be able to speak to you tonight and also to be able to engage in dialogue with Peter Atkins, who I know from being an undergraduate in chemistry at Oxford is a wonderful lecturer. I think you've heard that very well shown tonight. I want to talk about why I don't think we're going to rid the mind of God and why I don't think we want to either. If I had been told back in the 1960s that I'd be here speaking to an audience in Edinburgh on ridding the mind of God, I'd been very surprised, I think. Because I grew up in Belfast, and of course Edinburgh is very posh. And so the very idea of, you know, coming across to Edinburgh would be really quite spectacular for somebody who's born in Belfast. But also, I think, you know, if I'd known this debate was taking place, I'd have assumed I'd be on the side saying, let's get rid of this idea as quickly as possible. Because I, like many who were growing up in the late 1960s, took the view religion is evil, it's on the way out, it's for those who are mad, bad or sad, and it is going to be going out in my lifetime. And I believe that very, very strongly and also quite aggressively. And I'm sure you all know there are different kinds of atheists. There's a rather nice kind of atheist who will say, well, of course, I don't personally believe in God, but I'm so glad you do. I have to say to you that I was not like that. I was very, very aggressive, very much convinced that to make this world a safe place, a good place, the only way was to get rid of religion altogether. And certainly, growing up in Northern Ireland, you can understand precisely why that was. You watch this conflict between Protestants and Catholics, and you begin to realize there is something that is seriously wrong. I'm sure you all know the story of the Englishman who went to Belfast one night and unwisely went out late on Saturday night, and he was confronted by a group of yobbos with baseball bats. And they leaned at him menacingly and they said, are you a Catholic or are you a Protestant? But he was clever and he said, I'm an atheist. There was a pause. Are you a Catholic atheist or are you a Protestant atheist? And so for me, things really seemed elementary, very, very simple. And then I went to Oxford to read science, and to cut a very long story short, my world was inverted. I began to realize that the evidential basis for atheism was much weaker than I'd realized. And I began to realize that Christianity had the intellectual capacity to fascinate and the spiritual capacity to transform. And this really changed everything for me. And I began to realize I need to reorientate myself completely. Begin to rethink the relationship between science and faith, something I still do to this day. And beginning to wonder about questions that until this point have been non-questions for me altogether. And our topic tonight is about ridding the mind of God, using Darwin perhaps as a way in. I think it's a wonderful title. And certainly I'd want to say immediately that if belief in God were outmoded, or clearly evil, or clearly wrong, then it needs to go. But I do not believe it is outmoded, or wrong, or evil. It seems to me that what we are seeing is a rediscovery of not simply the idea of God, but also the capacity of God to animate existence, to give direction to life, and to bring us to a deeper sense of who we are. Now again, I grew up in the late 1960s, and if you read sociology textbooks dating from those times, then religion was on its way out. There was a secular future beckoning. The future was going to be bright and godless. It was all so elementary. That was the Darwinian way of things. That was the way it was then. That's the way it's going to be in the future, but it hasn't turned out like that. And in history of ideas, history of culture, we see patterns which are not simply migration in this direction all the time, but rather revisiting older ideas and beginning to rediscover that they have a life, an animation, a capacity to do wonderful things for us. And that, I think, is one of the things that intrigues me. I recently wrote a very short response to Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. And one of the questions I find myself wrestling with is this. If belief in God is so obviously wrong and outdated and evil, then why does it take 415 pages to show that that is the case? What we are seeing, I think, is a resurgence of interest in the idea that there might indeed be a God, and that this might indeed be not simply an idea that might be right, but also something that really has capacity to change the way we are. So I want to suggest to you tonight that maybe God is not going to disappear. Leszek Kolakowski, a very famous Polish Marxist philosopher, some of you will have read him, was writing in the depths of the very, very oppressive period that Poland went through under the regime directed from Moscow. And he wrote these words, and I think they are haunting words. God's unforgettableness means he is present even in the midst of rejection. Very powerful words. There's something about this that keeps it there. And it seems to me that if I were to try and say to you why I think we are not going to rid the mind of God, I will give you two reasons simply to begin our discussion tonight. Number one, because I believe it might be right. In fact, I believe it is right. And number two, because I believe also it is real. And those ideas are not the same. Professor Atkins and I have no doubt will argue about this, but it seems to me that belief in God gives you a framework for making sense of this mystery that we call life. Who are we? Why are we here? What's this thing all about? It helps us identify who we are, position ourselves on a map of possibilities. It opens up an intellectual landscape. It illuminates it and makes sense of it. C.S. Lewis once spoke these words. I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not simply because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. In other words, here's a framework, a way of looking at things, which actually makes sense of the world, ourselves, and it also, in my view, makes sense of the natural sciences. Richard Swinburne and many others have made the point that the explanatory successes of science themselves require explanation. And for me, it is enormously significant that so many scientists are Christians. Not all at all. Last year, we saw Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, Daniel Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, but also Francis Collins, director of the Human Genome Project, produced his intriguing book, The Language of God. Collins, an atheist who became a Christian, argued that in his view, the Christian faith made perfect sense of the evolutionary biology which he taught and which underlay the whole Human Genome Project that he directed. So I think there's a very important question here. Does science cause us to reject God? I hope it causes us to ask some hard questions. But reject? No. No. I think not. I think there's much more to this than meets the eye. Stephen Jay Gould, who as many of you know died recently from lung cancer, wrote back in the 1990s a wonderful article basically saying, look, there is no way that Darwinism is atheistic. Science, he writes, by its legitimate methods, I think he'd want to underscore that phrase, by its legitimate methods cannot adjudicate on the God question. We neither confirm it or deny it, we simply can't judge, he says. And as if to prove this, he then lines up all the evolutionary biology he can think of and finds he has two piles about the same size. This group, atheists and humanists, this group, orthodox religious believers. Doesn't prove anything. Very suggestive indeed. It seems to me it offers a way of thinking, which I personally believe to be right, defensible, the best explanation of the riddles that life throws at us and we long to make sense of. But more than that, it's also real. Real. That means not simply something that might be right, but something that actually produces meaning, that is significant. There are many things which, certainly I had to learn as a student, which I'm sure were right, but actually didn't seem terribly relevant at the time, and I have to say with the passage of time, I've even forgotten what they were. So the real issue is this. There are things that are right. The physical geography of Serbia, the political structures of the United States. We could list all these things. But that does not necessarily change your life. And for me, the really big question is this. Is there something which is not simply something we may believe to be true, but also has the capacity to engage, to transform, to give us a vision of who we are and where life is taking us? And for me, that's one of the things that Christianity does. It gives us that very powerful sense that we are valued, we are wanted, we are loved, We are special. It gives a platform from beginning to engage the world, trying to make sense of its riddles, but also affirming us in who we are. We can read this world in many different ways. We can read it atheistically. That's fine. We can read it agnostically. We can read it Christianly, and many other ways. But they are not all the same. When I was young, I used to be an amateur astronomer. I used to look at the night sky, and I knew just enough astronomy to know that the light from some of those stars wouldn't hit Earth for hundreds of years. And to me, that simply said to me, you'll be dead by then. And so the night sky was a symbol of melancholy, a reminder of the brevity of life, a challenge to meaning. Now I look at the same night sky, and the heavens declare the glory of the Lord. They're a reminder of God. They're also a reminder that God loves me, as he also loves you. This isn't just something that makes sense. It's something that is, in my view, charged with the capacity to transform life. Right, real, both up for debate, but for me, that's the way things are. Will Darwin rid the mind of religion? I think not. I think if we're talking about the best winning out in the longer term, maybe actually religion is on its way back, precisely because it corresponds to a real need on our part, but maybe also because it corresponds to the way things really are. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Professor McGrath. Can I invite Professor Atkins to respond?
Well, there we are. I'm sure that you appreciate that that was a superb portrayal of that great dichotomy where that science illuminates, where theology obfuscates. Even Professor McGrath's grasp of the title of this evening was not slightly weak. I'm not arguing against the fact that it will, that religion will be, that the mind will be rid of the mind of God, but it should be, not will be. I can entirely accept that such is the grip of religion on men's minds, that it is here to stay, and it is, to my deep regret, that that is the case. I think it's deplorable when I heard someone say, what is the evidence for atheism? That was said by Professor McGrath in his opening words. Atheism is the absence of a belief in anything. It's really the foundation on which evidence must be provided for placing anything further. If you assert that there, it is not for me to assert, to show evidence that there is not a God. It is for you to show that there is evidence for a God. Mine is, an empty slate on which evidence must be placed, and I have not seen one iota of evidence in the favour of the existence of God. I was rather entertained also by Professor McGrath's reasons for wanting there to be a God. It really does come down to psychology, as I'm sure you in the audience will have detected, that we heard phrases like wanting someone to love me, knowing that there was someone out there looking after me. I mean, it was deep, deep insecurity. And what we really have to look for is not, you know, why there is a God out there or why there isn't a God. We've got to try to understand why people believe that there is a God out there. What is the psychology of belief? The only interesting aspect of religion, it seems to me, is how people can be deep
be trapped by it. And they're trapped by it through all these insecurities and wanting to be give meaning to their life. I think that atheism can provide a framework, another term that I have to approach, can provide a framework for understanding where we are in the world. I rather like to think of myself as a consequence of undirected natural selection. And I'm rather pleased that I have emerged from slime. That I can understand that all you have emerged from slime, some I imagine slightly more than others. but it gives, I think the fact that the world is a rational place, a place that we can understand, a place that has no teleology in it, that there is no purpose in the world, that we are here to grip the opportunity that this accident of life has provided, I think that's an enormously heartwarming, spiritually uplifting knowledge about ourselves. I have to conclude, I see, but all I would like to say in response to Professor McGrath is that it was a sermon. It was not an articulation of any reason why there should be belief in God, other than this deep personal fear of annihilation and just wanting to be loved.
Well, I'm delighted to respond to this, as someone who's clearly very insecure. I think the issue really is this. I think I do disagree with Professor Atkins on a number of points. One of them is this idea that atheism is somehow the default position. I happen to think that is simply not the case. The default position is agnosticism. In other words, saying, look, this world is so complex that actually we cannot make sense of it. And you think, for example, of T.H. Huxley back in the 1870s, simply saying he was fed up with people dogmatizing with the utmost confidence that there was a God or there was not a God. For him, the evidence did not actually permit either of those conclusions to be reached. And in many ways, Huxley was simply saying, look, nature is open to multiple interpretations. The evidence for them is not knocked down. And therefore, you can either say, look, we can't make sense of this. But if you say there is no God or there is a God, you're actually going beyond the available evidence. And therefore, I would want to say in response, Professor Atkins, that I believe atheism to be a faith position. A faith position which is open to the same challenge as others. And indeed, in recent times, I think one could even make the case atheism has almost become a religion with its own high priests. But that might be another issue altogether. And certainly Professor Atkins is right to say there are very important psychological issues here. And certainly those of you who studied the social psychology of the emergence of early modern Europe will be aware that one of the reasons why atheism became so significant was this longing to make our own rules, to decide what we wanted to be right. Instead of doing this, we were able to make the rules. And therefore you can see that atheism also began to emerge in response to a human perception that this was what we wanted to be the case. That's not about insecurity, it's simply about identifying complex psychological pressures that have a real impact on our lives. For me, you respond to something, well, which is true, irrespective of where it leads you. If it leads you to say there is no meaning to life, that's fine. If you say it means you're loved, that's fine. The key question is, what is right? And for me, the way of looking at the world that says there is a God is one that makes much more sense, and also, I believe, to make more sense of the evidence. And I'm sure Professor Atkins and I will get on to this topic in the very near future. It seems to me that I'm not saying that Darwin is saying that that religion will disappear. I think Darwin is rather coy on applying his ideas to social, to intellectual evolution altogether. I'm simply saying that it seems to me, as it seems to many others, that the way in which our world is developing is saying there's something here which has an abiding significance, which has not been eliminated by the rise of scientific advance, which seems to have a significance which is able to inform, to transform, and to stabilize life. And it seems to me that's one of the reasons why this debate is attracting so much interest. There's something here that might be right, but certainly is important. I'll stop there, thank you.
Do you want to respond in any way? Put the session going.
But atheism is not a faith. I mean, I will not budge from the position that I come in with no beliefs whatsoever. I do not believe that there is a God. I do not believe that there's a tooth fairy. I do not believe in Santa Claus. I do not believe in anything. I'm prepared to believe in all those things if evidence can be provided. And no evidence has been presented this evening for the existence of a God. There is no reason for me to move away from my completely barren view of the world. Now, what evidence, what purported evidence has been presented by Professor McGrath has been entirely psychological. It's entirely to do with feelings about self-worth, place in the universe, and so on. None of that is convincing evidence that I should move away from the position that there's no need to believe in a God. I suppose I can be slightly more succinct in the following sense, that there is nothing in the world that requires the postulate of the existence of a God. Science can, if you want to confine yourself to science, which is, after all, the only true way of knowing anything. If you confine yourself to science, there is no aspect of the workings of the world that requires the introduction of a God figure. That would be total defeat of science, of course, should that ever be the case. So there's no need for a God. There's no evidence for a God. But you can, of course, understand the psychological pressures, and we've seen them displayed very well this evening, why people are desperate that there is this external meaning to oneself.
Well, I think I'd like to respond to those points. First of all, I think that the reason I shifted from atheism to Christianity was simply because I believed it was right. And again, those of you here tonight will know that, for example, if you read, for example, Gilbert Harman's very famous paper, Inference to the Best Explanation, or indeed Peter Lipton's recent, reworking
but
of that
God
theme.
God is not an explanation.
Can I just finish?
Yeah.
That one of the key questions here is how on earth we make sense of the world. And the point that Harman and Lipton make is really very simple. We are faced with an enormously complex world with competing explanations.
So we cop out.
No, join five.
I thought you wanted an exchange.
No, well, I did make my comments, and then you're very welcome to come back. And the point I'm making is that there are many explanations, and the real difficulty is trying to work out which is the case, when simply scientific explanation is not going to take us very far. And again, Professor Atkins and I think are going to disagree on this.
How far has religious explanation taken us?
I think, I'll just make my point and I'll come back to you, if I may. Again, Professor Atkins is really giving us science as the answer to the world's intellectual issues, and I would say more than that. But again, the point I would want to raise is this. One of the big questions in life is this. What is the good, and how may we live the good life? And it seems to me that science really has difficulty in answering that question.
If
I may, and then I will gladly hand over to you, and I promise I will not interrupt.
Oh, no, I'd like you to interrupt.
I will not interrupt.
It's more
don't worry. Let's take a good example of someone who I think makes this point very well. That's Peter Medawar, who, in a very interesting book, Medawar was a a medical man, as you will know, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine back in the 1960s. In his book, The Limits of Science, published in 1987, Medawar makes this point. He makes the point that in his view, science is outstanding. It is the best form of knowledge we can hope to have within its limits. And the point he makes simply is that when it comes to the correlation of incidents in the physical world, the material world, it's wonderful. In principle, there are no limits to what it does or indeed can do. When we start talking about value or meaning, it's different. And Medawar ends the discussion of the limits of science by simply saying the existence of a limit to science is shown by its inability to answer, and he gives some examples of questions of meaning. Why are we here? What's the point of it all? And it seems to me these are real questions. I love the sciences. I have no problem with them at all. But the issue is, there's more to life than that. And my concern is, where does science leave us, and where do we move on from there?
Well, there's an exercise. There's an exercise in theological disputation by appealing to authority, written authority, this time not the book of Isaiah, but the book of Peter Medawar. One should never refer to authority to support oneself, really. Medawar's quite wrong. There are no limits to science. Point to a limit that science has ever encountered. Humanity should be proud that through the really stumbling upon this complex procedure, but rather simple procedure we call the scientific method, it has found a way of discovering the truth about anything of importance. It can discover everything. It's a mode of discovering everything about the material world. It's also a mode of discovering the truth about the inner world of the psyche. I see nothing that science, the scientific method, is incapable of touching. And it can elucidate not only the structure of an atom, but also the foundation of religious belief. Science is people should be proud that humanity has stumbled on this way of discovering the truth after all those years of obfuscation by religious argumentation. I don't know what else I want to say about that. I would take the view, if you like, that the meaning. Well, yes, let me say the following. I think that many of the questions of the world that really worry theologians and maybe everyone in the room are purely invented questions. They're invented, for example, you invent, why am I here? What's the purpose of the world? Wholly invented. You can't expect there to be a real answer to a wholly invented question. Why should there be a purpose in the world? Theologians really make a living out of inventing questions and then denying that science can tackle them. Science can tackle them by showing that they are just pointless questions.
Well, I don't think the question of what is good and what is evil is a pointless question.
No, but it can answer it. Science can answer it. Well, science answers it through looking at our evolutionary history to see the emergence of, if you like, ethological ideas.
How would you respond to that?
It's far better to know where we come from than to than to appeal to some sort of God.
Let me respond to that point, and then I'd like to respond to an earlier point, which Professor Atkins very helpfully made, but I think also makes the point. Richard Dawkins and I disagree on many things, but I think the point he makes is that in the final pages of The Selfish Gene are right. That he in effect says, look, here is how we came to be where we are. And then he makes this very powerful statement that we alone have the power to resist our genes. In other words, the biological explanation of how we came to be where we are, and indeed whatever values these these genes may force upon us to continue his anthropocentric way of looking at them, we have the power to resist them. And again, the key point for me is, what is good, what is evil? And again, I do not dismiss this as a trivial theological question. It is one of the most fundamental questions that humanity asks. And again, Richard Dawkins and I do disagree on many things, but in this book, The Devil's Chaplain, I mean, I think he makes a point which surely is right, and that is, science has no means of deciding what is right in terms of the morality of things.
But it does have a means of understanding how we have come to view particular actions as right or wrong.
Yes, but the issue here is that clarification of mechanism is not equivalent to establishing meaning.
Yes, it is.
And no, it's not. I think that
that's the whole point.
I can clarify the mechanism by which I try to work out what is right and what is wrong. And it may help me to make some adjudications, but in the end, I'm going to have to make some adjudications.
I would go out on a limb, and I know I'm going to lose everyone in the audience now. I think there is no question, no real question, that begins with the word why. Every question that has significance begins with the word how. And even why questions should be deconstructed into how questions.
I think... I think there is no doubt that scientific explanation offers us one level of explanation which is enormously helpful, but does not exhaust explanation.
It does.
And I don't think it does. Again, I can point at somebody in the audience and you give a very good account of how neurologically I did that, of how my musculoskeletal system performed, but there's still something behind that, namely my intention in doing this.
Yeah, but no, there isn't a God behind it.
Well, I don't know. I mentioned God here. I think the point I was trying to make, and I think that the real gist of our discussion, is whether there are limits to what science can help us understand.
And there aren't.
And I think there are. And I think that...
That's really the crucial question for us here this evening.
Well,
is science capable of answering every real question and showing, if you like, that some questions are stupid?
Well, I think we can all agree some questions are really stupid, and it's very helpful to have that way of clarifying the issues. But it also seems to me to be enormously important to say that science may be helpful, but it does have limits, and when we go beyond those...
Give me an example of a limit.
Well, again, what is good? What, in terms of...
It's what we think is good. I mean... There are two pressures, as I said in my introductory talk, both of which you've alluded to a moment ago. There are the evolutionary pressures, which sort of ingrain in us a sense of a kind of behaviour which we regard as good. I mean, we don't eat our own children, because that's rather destabilising in our evolution. But we've also got big enough brains to see the wider consequences of our actions. And it's that interaction between the genetic control, if you like, the ethological control of our actual behaviour, and the intellectual view of the consequences that really is the basis of morality.
Well, I think, you very kindly suggested you were putting your neck out. I'm going to put my neck out and say, I think we need to say there's some good science and there's some bad science. And I'm very concerned that we are moving towards we take scientific ideas and use them for ideas that we think are good, but may not be so at all. And it seems to me there's a real need to say not just good is what we think it is, but rather there has to be some way of challenging us, some way of saying that simply because Hitler says this is good, we all go that way, or we didn't go with Nietzsche and the herd instinct. There has to be some way of challenging us on what we think is good.
But if you were brought up in the Congo, you might come to a completely different vision about what's good. Eating your grandmother might be a good thing to do there. So, I mean, it's far, far better to know the roots of our behaviour than to relate them to the cultural milieu in which we've been brought up.
And this stage, we want to move into a time of question and answer. So if you have any questions, Rachel on this side, and Chris, if you can come and grab this mic, please. Thank you. And we're going to try and move the mics around and hear the questions.
Yes, my question is for Professor Atkins. My question is, in my understanding of the scientific method, it works by proposing a hypothesis and then attempting to disprove it. That science never actually proves anything ultimately, but only through repeated experimentation can things not be disproved and be accepted as ongoing theories, as long as they're useful for further scientific inquiry. Now, when there's something that you've no way of testing, such as the theory of God, if there's no way to test this, to attempt to disprove that hypothesis, isn't that a question that science is not qualified to speak on?
Well, of course, there's that hoary old example from Bertrand Russell about proposing that there's a teapot in orbit around Mars. Could science ever be used to disprove that there was such a teapot? Anyone can come up with potty ideas. It doesn't. And the hypothesis that there is a God is just a kind of off-the-wall one. It's the same category as there being a teapot in Mars. There is no evidence that there is a teapot in Mars. There's no evidence that there is a God. So why waste time?
Yes, I'd like to respond, just amplify this. I mean, one of the reasons why I moved away from atheism was studying the history and philosophy of science, beginning to realize that one might say with complete confidence, this is the way science understands things at the moment, and we believe it to be right, but being aware that the process of development is such that ideas that were thought right in the past no longer thought right now, and others will be so as well. And so really just amplifying your point, it seems to me to be very, very difficult to base atheism on science, simply because of the provisionality of the scientific method. And again, I mean, we're talking about Darwin tonight. I mean, dare I be very, very radical and say that in 150 years' time, we may have to abandon Darwinism completely, or actually replace it with something which bears very little relationship to it. So it seems to me that science is in much more of a flux than I think Professor Atkins allows. And that, I think, has implications for what we can base on the sciences, but also the broader question of how we recognize the provisionality of so many of these conclusions we draw.
The lady in the blue in the central gantry. Thank you.
This is a question for Professor Atkins, actually, and I'm afraid you may find it rather simplistic question. But you seem to be a great advocate of the purposelessness of the world and life in general, and I was just going to ask you, does that not make you a little bit sad?
No. There's two kinds of purpose. There's cosmic purpose, and there is personal purpose. Cosmic purpose is really the, you know, why was the world made? And I regard that as a total nonsense question, a teapot in orbit around Mars question. Perfect for theological discourse, but complete waste of time. Personal purpose is quite different. You know, it's really a way of getting through life in an interesting, non-destructive as possible manner. And so to have a personal purpose in, for example, coming here this evening, I can understand. I couldn't understand it neurologically, although one day that will be possible, I'm sure. But one that should distinguish the personal purpose from the cosmic purpose. One is a real thing motivated by desire to have fun while one has this one shot at life, and the cosmic purpose is just an invented question.
Gentleman in the black t-shirt there. Yeah.
Hi, this is Professor McGrath. I think I'm Napoleon. I this gives rather wonderful dignity and purpose because, you know, and it explains everything. It explains why I enjoy putting my hand in my jacket. And it makes me feel wonderful because, you know, I'm really good at battles. It makes me feel absolutely fantastic. You know, actually, you may have realized by now that I just lied to you there. But where does this differ from your belief in God? What's the difference? Is it because there's more people believe in God than I believe in Napoleon? Or where does the difference come?
Well, there is no Napoleon. So you can't be Napoleon. You're deluded.
I'm sorry. I'm sir.
No, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, my answer was flippant, and thank you for taking it with such good humour, but the point I was trying to make is actually, in order to answer that question, we need to have a shared idea of what we're talking about. And it just seems to me, actually, one of the big questions an atheist tries to engage with, and certainly this puzzled me when I was an atheist myself, is if there is no God, then why on earth do so many people believe there is one? And of course, the answer would be, well, because they are deluded, or they are slightly eccentric, or they're downright dangerous. And I accept these are all options we do need to look at very, very seriously. But to do justice to you, I'd have to say, well, you know, are you Napoleon? I mean, you have to actually look at that. And it seems to me there is a real issue here which actually might the question be answered simply by saying there is something called God which many believe in and find real as well.
But they don't find it real in any real sense. All it is a state of mind, a psychological state of mind. It, really, it is a delusion and nothing more than that. It's a self-delusion. The whole of religion is a self-delusion, which is impressed upon people by the culture in which they emerge, and really the entire surroundings of society. And I also don't believe that Professor McGrath was really an atheist, ever. I think he was a covert Christian.
Professor Atkins really believes in something.
The day he was that
I'm a little concerned that Professor Atkins seems to be saying that if he can't answer the question with science, it's therefore not a real question. To me, that smacks of a certain degree of arrogance.
Yeah. One of the phrases that I really most deeply regret having made in my life was on a TV program about a month ago, where I said that I was accused of being arrogant, and I said, and I regret to repeat it here actually, but I will, what's wrong with being arrogant when you're right? But I wish I hadn't said it, and I wish I hadn't repeated it this evening as well. But I think what I will nail my colours to the mast over is that experiment is a better route to knowledge than sentiment. I think that the whole of religious argument of belief is really driven by sentiment, and which I don't trust. Whereas I do trust experiment because it is it's carried out in the public domain. People can share it, people can test it. And so I think that experiment, insofar as that is the embodiment of science, is the best way, and really only way we have, of being sure about anything. And I think that the scientific method can be brought to bear on every kind of question, including those whose answers are all to do with psychology.
I'm fascinated by that question because, again, Professor Atkins, I'm sure, is right to stress the importance of experimentation. But experimentation is not going to adjudicate between meanings of different kinds. Let me give an example. Many people have read Dennis Noble's book, The Music of Life. It's a very good exploration of some issues in contemporary biology published last year. And what he does is he compares himself and Richard Dawkins. A quote from Richard Dawkins in which we are there to serve the genes, and his own reworking of that quote in which genes are there to serve us. He makes the point. These are radically different metaphysically and also morally. He then makes the point they are empirically indistinguishable. I think that's extremely important. I respect Peter Atkins' emphasis on the importance of experiment. It's brought us a long way. But there are issues where basically there are core issues of truth, metaphysics, morals, where I don't think experiment is going to answer those questions at all. And I don't believe that means we say, therefore, they can't be answered. I think it means we look elsewhere for those answers.
You see, there's a primary difference. There's a primary difference, I think, between a scientist and a philosopher. A philosopher is, by inclination, a pessimist, whereas a scientist is, by inclination, an optimist. And scientists and philosophers simply have to change their degree of pessimism or the target of their pessimism as the optimism of science drives it further forward.
Okay. Move on to the next question. Lady here at the front.
My question is, to the two of you, I was quite surprised and fascinated by everything you said, because I don't think that once you said that you knew God existed, you always said you believed. And what I'm wondering is, if God were to come down and prove to us that he existed, I believe Professor Atkins would be shocked. We'd get it sorted, and you know, God exists once and for all, and at least Professor Atkins would go home now, and he was wrong and God does exist. But what I wonder is, wouldn't it lose all its meaning to you? You talk a lot about meaning, but if God did prove to us that he existed, what would happen about your belief?
Right, well, I think that's a good point. The English language is fascinating, and the word belief in plain English very often has a weak sense. I think this is right, but I can't show it. And very often we find ourselves in situations where we do passionately believe things are right and yet can't prove them. Again, to give you a simple example, I believe democracy is better than fascism, but I have a job proving that. But nevertheless, it's an extremely important judgment for me. But of course, the word belief or faith for a Christian actually means rather more than that. And your question invites me to go beyond that, so I'm very happy to do that. For a Christian, the word faith implies not simply something that cannot absolutely be proven. I think that is part of the package. But actually something that may nonetheless be relied upon. It's something that one can base one's life on. And it seems to me that I want to make a distinction between cognitive and existential evaluation of the situation. Cognitively, I may be in a position where I can say, look, I believe this to be so, but no, I cannot prove this with absolute certainty. And many of us are in precisely that position about many of the big questions of meaning. But existentially, in terms of the way I engage with life, the way I approach things, I would say this is so good, this is so right, that actually I'm going to base my life on the assumption that this is so. And that is really where I am. So your question is a good question, and it's a very fair question. I've used the language of belief because we're talking to a philosophical society. I thought it might be good, but I thought in terms of my own personal way of looking at things, there's the cognitive side of things where you evaluate arguments, but then there's a level of personal existence. And for me, this is right, this is real. And I hesitate to use the word proof because it's a word that means different things to different people. But certainly, for me, it is a certainty that I believe I can live life on, but an existential certainty. I believe I can commit myself to this, it changes everything, and for that reason, it's something I believe I can take forward in that way.
How would your life change if you were suddenly to lose your faith?
Well, I think when I lost my faith as an atheist, my life changed radically.
Oh.
And so I suspect if I were to regain my faith as an atheist, it would...
It is not faith. It is definitely not faith. I am sure that the starting point for any argument should be the statement of the least complex hypothesis, and to see how far that takes one. And in my view, the least complex hypothesis is that there is not a God.
Thank you for taking my questions. Thank you, gentlemen, for visiting us here in Edinburgh. My question is for Professor McGrath. I apologize, but it excludes Professor Atkins by default. The question is, can you offer some of the fundamental tenets appropriate to for an appropriate epistemic model for Christian revelation? Can you offer some fundamental tenets for an appropriate epistemic model of Christian revelation?
I will answer that question, but I suspect it may be a somewhat limited section of the audience that wants me to. I think one has to begin by asking what you mean by revelation, because that is not a word that has a self-evident, self-determined meaning, and therefore, to answer your question, I really know what you mean by that word, so I can adjust it to what I mean by that word. I'm sorry about this, but... I need to know what you mean by that word so I can...
A general Christian doctrine, a Christian view.
So you want me to...
Your view.
My view on... Revelation. No, what do you mean by revelation?
How do you know things that God has revealed versus an epistemology from things of below?
Well, I think if we take the New Testament, which again seems to me to be a very good place to begin to answer this question, I mean, one of the critical questions there, and I think it's a critical question in terms of how we engage with the world, is how do we make sense of what we saw happening? And again, if we take, for example, the Gospel of Mark, which is a very good example of this. In the Gospel of Mark, you see Jesus doing certain things, saying certain things, and provoking the response, how on earth do we make sense of this? And there are various options. He might be mad. He might be some kind of deceiver. Or there might be something more to this. And the whole question of revelation for me is trying to take a view of all that is there on the table, all that's given, and asking what is the best way of making sense of this in terms of the idea that in some way this may disclose the way God is. And of course, for Christians, again, if I was being very, very narrow and specific, that question of revelation is actually very specifically focused on the identity of Jesus. And the big question really in the New Testament is, to know what God is and what God is like, do we look at Jesus Christ or do we look elsewhere? And the classic Christian answer is this, that Christ brings to fulfillment the pointers we see elsewhere, but that he in some way brings them to a greater clarity and a greater fullness. So what can be known of God, for example, through nature, is actually disclosed much, much more fully. Now, I would need to give a lecture to even begin to answer your question properly, but I've just sketched how I'd like to begin in response to that good question.
I thought there was an interesting philosophical point raised earlier on, and my question is in two parts, since to both speakers. Professor Atkins mentioned that atheism is the simplest explanation for the existence of the universe, etc. I was wondering what the justification is for it being a simplest explanation, because on matters of metaphysics, it's not at all obvious which explanation would be the simplest. And the second part of that is, why do we appeal to the simplest explanation in the first place? What's the justification for the universe having to be simple?
I think that's a very hard question, really. The alternative, if I could turn the question round to the statement that God made the world is one of extreme complexity that reveals nothing and enables one to draw no conclusions, really, other than the sort of codswallopy sort of conclusions of, typical of religion. I think, insofar as the human mind is, through the scientific method, seeking comprehension, it will achieve it if it can express the origin of the world in a very simple mathematical way. And that is the way to enlightenment. I think any use of the word God in relation to any explanation is actually a deceit for saying that I really don't know. I think simplicity is really what scientists are after, and it's shown over the last 300 years to be of enormous potency.
I don't think the best explanation is always the simplest explanation. I think that needs to be said. Again, I mentioned inference the best explanation. Peter Lipton's recent analysis of that. What are the epistemic virtues? Maybe simplicity is one of them, but there are others as well. It's not really quite that straightforward. But again, I would just refer you to Richard Swinburne. I mean, Swinburne's argument is actually the postulation of God is the most economical explanation, which actually involves positing God, but not having to posit many other things. So in terms of simplicity and elegance, by those criteria, it is very much in the running.
It's absolutely not. To say that God did anything is a sign of intellectual defeat. And anyone who believes that saying God did it has reached understanding is deluded.
I'm afraid that is all the questions we have time for. I very much hope that conversations will continue after this. Can I invite the two speakers, perhaps first Professor Atkins and then Professor McGrath, to give closing statements?
Oh dear. Yes, I know that people have come here with fixed minds, but because of the cultural conditioning that goes on 2 minutes already. Yes. I mean, this discussion will go on forever, but I think we shouldn't forget Darwin's role, other than really being the peg on which this discussion has been hung. He did make open and the route to an understanding of the human condition. He did open the route to understanding really the entire biosphere, which is the most complex thing that we are currently aware of. And I see no reason why knowledge of our emergence from slime diminishes the wonder of the world. I think it adds to our delight in being alive that we can understand our origins, and that it illuminates for me the human condition, the place of a human in the whole complex of organic material on the surface of the earth and perhaps elsewhere. I can see that it ultimately will lead to an understanding of why people believe in God, because it illuminates the structure of our brains, and the structure of our brains really is responsible in large measure for the way that this delusion can take root and flourish in them. I think we have a lot to ask, to thank Darwin for, but most of all, self-knowledge.
I don't think Darwin helps us understand why we believe in God at all. I think the question is wide open. I admire Professor Atkins' emphasis on the sciences. In fact, in many respects, he and I agree on an awful lot, and above all, the from what I hear, the beauty of nature. I agree with him entirely, and I love the sciences because they open up that beauty and that wonder. I think the main difference between us is whether you stop there, or whether actually the beauty and wonder of nature might be pointing beyond itself, like light from a distant valley, or you know, a mountain peak you can just see in the distance. Is science complete in itself? Is nature complete in itself? Or is the pointer to something wonderful that lies beyond, which is there for us to discover, and a great enrichment to our lives? That's why I think this debate remains wide open, though I've loved this debate tonight, and I think you've asked us some wonderful questions.
First of all, I would like to thank Professor Peter Atkins and Professor Alice McGrath for coming all the way up to Edinburgh to speak to us tonight. It's been an honour to have you here tonight. It's been a fantastic debate. Thank you very much. I would also like to thank the Christian Union. When we look at the world today, the things we should fear the most and the things we should fight the most are ignorance and extremism. And the way to fight them is by doing exactly what we're doing right now, engaging in open discussion. And this isn't always easy, right? It's like two worlds colliding, really. I mean, there's religious people, there's atheists, there's all sorts of different beliefs which are very difficult to articulate. People are even talking about different things. And of course, the arguments get heated in the process. It's not an easy thing to do. But we need this, we need the open discussion. It leads towards tolerance, it leads towards respect, and it leads towards a better world. I would like to thank the Christian Union for setting such a good example of this. And I would like to thank our speakers for being willing to represent the different points of view. Thank you very much.
Christian Union, to the speakers, Professor Atkins, to Mr. McGrath, and to thank the Philosophy Society on behalf of the Christian Union for their excellent partnership in enabling this event to go forward. A few more brief words of thanks, if I may, to the technical people who've enabled this evening to work out. We want to thank them very much. I want to simply close by again thanking you all very much for coming. We hope that these kinds of discussions will be ongoing in the future, and that both in the Christian Union context and the Philosophy Society, maybe in these sorts of forums in the future, we can actually take our information that really matter and discuss them properly. So thank you very much for coming. And a last word, simply to say, we need to be out of here by 8 o'clock. So if you could wait at least for a moment until the speakers are there. And we very much hope these discussions will be ongoing. Thank you very much for coming.